Hello, I'm Steve Behrman, and welcome to WikiPoliticky, a political conversation for co-creation where we bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together to turn the funk into function and leave the junk at the junction. On this show, we'll be talking with solutionaries, luminaries, and others who hold key pieces to seeing where we are, acknowledging how we've gotten here, and setting us on a course for what our colleague Charles Eisenstein calls the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Now, in order to get to that beautiful world, sometimes we have to uncover things that are not really very pleasant. As we do this, we can do this in a way that sheds light on the endarkened corridors of power and helps us recognize that together we can overcome these challenges and difficulties. So, to do that, we're going to need a lot of love and a lot of laughter, which is why my cohort and colleague, Swami Beyondananda, will be offering his cosmic comic wisdom and uncommentary as part of the program later on. His favorite yoga pose is tongue-in-cheek, and we hope it's not foot-in-mouth. And in these times of radical revelation, the veils are being lifted on many of the toxic perpetrations that have put us into our current, new word, situation. And we need plenty of love and laughter to metabolize what we have to face together. So if we are to heal the body politic and operate from a field of love and sanity, we have to be able to do this really all at the same time, be able to hold the love and be able to look at the darkness. Of course, now we're still reeling from one of the most bitter and toxic and divisive electoral seasons in our lifetime, maybe any lifetime, and we seem to be caught in a crossfire between a president at war with reality and a press that cannot be trusted to tell the whole truth. People are dazed and confused. Everywhere I go, people ask the question, is this the hand of God at work or just the middle finger? Well, in order to assess how we got here and a way up and out toward the more beautiful world, we have to talk about today that which we can't talk about. Yes, we have to talk about it now, and we are going to start in the middle. Actually, we're going to start many, many years ago. We're going to start in 1968, 49 years ago, and this is being recorded on the 49th anniversary of a tragic event, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee. And if you know the official story, there was a petty criminal, James Earl Ray, who was the accused assassin. He was put in jail. He died in prison. However, there may be another story. There may be a likelier story, even that's not a lovelier story. It's a likelier story. And our guest here today is here to shed light on this right now. So on April 4th, 1968 was the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. But something happened a year before, 50 years ago, April 4th, 1967. Martin Luther King delivered a famous speech against the Vietnam War. And he made that change at that point from being a civil rights leader to being an anti-war leader, and that might have been what got him killed. My guest today, William Pepper, has spent much of the past 49 years seeking to shed light on this dark moment. He was a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King. He is a human rights lawyer, and he represented Dr. King's widow, Coretta Scott King, and James Earl Ray in a civil case in 1999 and managed to convince the jury that the convicted killer, James Earl Ray, was framed and the assassination was a much bigger and more important and more nefarious plot. He's already written two books about his investigations and the subsequent trial, and he just published his third book, The Plot to Kill King, that reveals new details about the murder, the plot, and how and why James Earl Ray became the patsy. Welcome, Bill Pepper.
Yes, hello.
Okay, glad you're here. Glad you're with us. We're gonna jump right in. You've been maintaining that James Earl Ray was innocent. Who killed King, and how did they get away with it?
Well, the long and the short of it is that the government of the United States, agencies of the United States, killed Martin King. The key agency in the development of the assassination, the plot of the assassination, was the FBI under Hoover. He used Clyde Tolson, his number two, to be the go-between with the Dixie Mafia group in Memphis as they organized the assassination of Martin King. And they got away with it because they controlled all aspects of the investigation, and they had set James up as a patsy. They arranged his escape from prison and used him and developed him throughout the year 1967 and 68 for that purpose. So that's a brief summary of what happened. I go through the details of that in considerable detail in the book. So, that's the summary.
Good. Well, we got the summary. That's excellent. I'm curious as to how this came about. How did you become involved with it, and how did you come to find this out? And then you can tell us a little more about how you presented it in a court of law and had the jury decide that indeed it was this conspiracy and not James Earl Ray.
Well, over a period of the many years in which I was involved in the case, witnesses came forward often close to the time when they were near their deathbeds, and revealed information that they knew and had held for a long period of time. I detail all of this in the third book, The Plot to Kill King, and I not only detail it, but I set forth the depositions, the sworn testimonies that we took. By the time of the trial in 99, we were three-quarters of the way there. 17 years later, we had the complete picture with all of the story that emerged.
Tell us about the case in 1999. Where was the court? How was it presented? I take it was a civil case, obviously, not a criminal case. Where was the court? How was it presented? And how and when did the jury decide?
It was presented in Memphis, Tennessee, in Shelby County Circuit Court, which was a civil proceeding. And we sued one of the perpetrators, Lloyd Jowers, and we sued Jowers for the purpose of allowing the proceeding to go forward and allowing us to put on all of the evidence that we had at that point in time. It took the jury after 70 witnesses and 30 days of testimony. It took the jury 59 minutes to decide that James Earl Ray was an unwitting patsy, and that the main perpetrators of the crime were the government of the United States and various individuals related to the state of Tennessee and the Memphis Police Department.
So I'm going to ask the rhetorical question, which is, why doesn't anybody know about this? What happened after that? I'm sure that, that's like, obviously would have to be one of the biggest stories any paper could cover, any news service could cover. Was there any coverage when this trial was done?
No. The media, the corporate media in America is totally blocked in terms of this. A case as sensitive and information as sensitive as this. So the corporate media was totally blocked and did not cover it. They might have been present in the courtroom when Coretta testified or any of the children or Andy Young, but they were out of the courtroom deliberately when the critical evidence was being heard. So that is that's really what happened. And now the corporate media has suppressed this story, continues to suppress it. The progressive media, for the most part, is not much better. And that's what's really disappointing, that you don't have, thank goodness for people like you and your program that can air this stuff. But for the most part, this story is going to be buried and suppressed for as long as they can do that.
You know, it's interesting that the phrase conspiracy theory is used to slander a lot of these ideas that are outside the mainstream, and yet you have, did you say, 70 depositions? I mean, this is not like speculation.
No. There's no speculation here. And starting in 64, the CIA started to float this idea of conspiracy theorists and attach it to anyone that threatened to question the assassinations of John Kennedy or Malcolm X and, of course, Martin King. And that's what they do. And their representatives in the media are very adept at putting this forward. But it enables them not to deal with any of the real facts that come through. If you read The Plot to Kill King, you will see the details, the factual details of the assassination and how it was worked up, how it was developed, how Clyde Tolson came into Memphis on a regular basis, how he brought money in to pay people off so that they would participate, and how he caused people in King's own organization to betray him. So we had massive betrayals going on throughout the case and throughout the course of this action.
That was one of the most shocking things that I saw in looking at this material, looking at the books, and that was the people on King's own team who were part of the plot. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, he was betrayed. He was betrayed by people like Reverend Billy Kiles, Reverend Jesse Jackson. It was Jackson who, from what the eyewitnesses told us, was responsible for changing the room from 202, secluded, secure room, to 306, an exposed room up on the balcony. So he was simply betrayed. There's no question about that.
So I want to ask a little bit more personal about this. First of all, how did you become involved in this investigation? And then, how have you been able to metabolize all of this stuff? I mean, you're reading about betrayals. You're looking at people. You're seeing them on the news, and they're holding forth like everything is normal. How do you? What's the internal psychology of something like that?
Well, I mean, I knew Martin only the last year of his life. He and I were very close. He asked to meet with me when I came back from Vietnam. I was a journalist in Vietnam, and I was basically the one who turned him against the war in Vietnam. So he saw my photographs of the maimed and burned children in villages and all of that, and he decided that was it. So he delivered the Riverside speech on April 4, 67. He and I then became close in the last year of his life in an effort from the National Conference on New Politics to develop what amounted to a radical organization to try to change the whole focus of American government. His opposition to the war was not the reason they killed him, in my view. They killed him, in my view, because he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington. And they were going to petition their congressmen and senators to put money back in social programs taken away from the war, and the military was concerned, and I think rightly concerned, that group was going to be frustrated by rejections, and that might have led to a revolution happening in the nation's capital, because they were not going there to march; they were going there to camp and to be there as a force. And there was a possibility that there would be a revolution. Remember, 100 cities burned that year. Remember, there almost was a revolution in in France, in Paris, and if it hadn't been for André Malraux counseling de Gaulle, there might have been a revolution in France. They were very afraid that this was going to take place in America. And so they were never going to allow Martin to leave Memphis and bring that mob to Washington. So they had to kill him.
It's an interesting story that way. You know, I lived in D.C. right around that time. I remember Resurrection City. They did, as a matter of fact, in the late spring of 1968, they did bring the Poor People's Campaign, and Reverend Abernathy was in charge of that, and we even put up some people who were visiting. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, it's similar to what happened with JFK, if you're familiar with James Douglas's book about the unspeakable, JFK and the unspeakable, why he died and why it mattered. And according to Douglas, the American military establishment was really concerned that, you know, we had a leader who was anti-military, who seemed to be taking the country in a direction of something that was going to be different. And they could have justified that based on we did it to save the country. So as you're saying that was their rationale, how does that feel?
Well, I mean, I think it's frightful, obviously, and horrific, because it totally goes contrary to democratic impulses and the use of mobilization and demonstration and nonviolent resistance. But that was the reality. That was what they were determined to do. They couldn't co-opt King. They couldn't change him. And he had such a large following. He was a threat. So they had to get rid of him.
Why do you figure that the people inside his campaign actually betrayed him? What was in it for them to do that, do you figure?
They were paid money.
Paid money. Yeah. The old money thing. You know, the carrot and the stick. First,
they
we'll give you the carrot,
and paid.
Then
yeah.
So you've been holding. This has been your. I'm sure you've done many other things in your lifetime, but this has been a conversation that you've been holding for many years. What do you expect can come from? You know, and it may sound like a dumb question. Why are you doing it? How have you been able to keep moving forward with this in the face of the stonewalling by the media?
Well, I mean, it's just a slippery slope. I got involved and I didn't pull out. And I had to move my first family to England because of the threats, and I couldn't raise the children in that kind of environment. So they were all raised in England. And then I commuted back and forth. I just felt, frankly, that I owed it to Martin, and I owed it to this republic. I'm a first-generation American, and this was something that I found so abhorrent that I had to just persist and try to do the best I could. And I think Martin's life and death deserved nothing less. So I just persisted. That's all.
What do you think positive might come out of this? In other words, do you think that this will come out? And if it does, what would be the positive benefits of this, particularly at a time when people don't even understand history anymore? You know, just, you know, if it happened 2 weeks ago, huh? You know, they don't know. What do you figure could be the positive benefits of actually having the story be revealed?
Well, perhaps Americans will become more sophisticated in terms of what their government is about. America is, as Martin said, the largest purveyor of violence in the world. And the American system, the American corporate capitalist system, which is determined to dominate the resources of the planet and the wealth of the planet, leads it down these kinds of roads. And the people don't understand that. They're not educated to be aware of the reality of their government. This is an empire. And It's important that they understand. If they can tolerate it if they wish, but at least they should understand the system under which they live and the effect of this system upon the world.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important. I think we're the veils are, you know, the term apocalypse means the lifting of the veils originally, and the veils seem to be lifting on so many things, particularly this whole idea about the deep state, et cetera, even though there's many distortions going on. There's revelations about pedophilia in high places and in that sort of those kinds of nefarious doings. And what would how could the American public be prepared to actually turn this into something that is empowering rather than numbing?
Well, if the American people, first of all, have to understand the nature of the problem, they have to understand the core illness of the society, and the values that are underlying values that really are dominating it, and once they understand that, then they have to begin to think about how the existing system of electoral politics can be used, and how they can put people into positions of power who will reverse the trends that have existed going back 60 years or more, and from the Cold War period. But they can't do that unless they are aware of the illness itself, of the innate sickness of the society and its impact on the world.
It's definitely true, I'm afraid. I want to go way, way, way back to how you got to Vietnam to be able to do that article and take those photos. You were obviously, were you a journalist? Were you an attorney? How did you get there?
No, I went as a journalist, but I was not representing any major news media. I went as and became accredited as a journalist, and went on borrowed money because I was very concerned about everything I heard that was going on. Everything I heard that was going on in the world, I simply had to go.
And there you have it. And you started something. And you've stayed with it. As so many people have turned the other. I've read a piece by a journalist who's been an independent journalist, and he was talking about how, when he first started his career, he had the opportunity to become, you know, to join a well-established mainstream publication, and he started to realize. I mean, you wrote your thing for Ramparts, right? And that was a rather alternative publication.
Yes.
And he recognized that if he wrote for this other publication, he would really not be able to cover these kinds of things, that he realized he would be compromising himself, and then for his salary, and then he'd have the excuse, well, I'm supporting my family. You took your family to England to protect them for the work that you were doing. When you were in the midst of doing that, did you have doubts about that? Did you go, am I crazy or something?
No, I mean, it was just something that I had to do to protect them and to allow me to continue unfettered and in the work that I had chosen to do.
I've got two more questions. One, of all of the revelations about this case, what was it that was the most, I would use the word, shocking to you?
I guess the degree of involvement of agents, senior agents of the government of the United States in setting up this assassination. The degree of detail and involvement of those agents and the extent of their involvement was revelatory. I didn't think it was I didn't think it went the control. I didn't think went that close to the highest levels.
And you did mention J. Edgar Hoover and Tolson.
Clyde Tolson was the front man for Hoover. He was the one who came in all the time. He was the one who brought the money. He was the one who brought the instructions. He was the one who paid for the for James Earl Ray to be allowed to escape after they had profiled him as a convict who would be an ideal patsy. And I have an eyewitness who went to the prison for the delivery of the money to the warden.
Wow. After the election, I sent out a piece to the people who are on my list, and I said, it's time for deep political education. I had them watch Oliver Stone's series, The Untold History of the United States, and so on, 12-part series. So I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to say, people out there listening to this, the latest book is called The Plot to Kill King. The first one, that was An Act of State. Was that the first book?
That was the second book. The first book was Orders to Kill.
Orders to Kill, An Act of State, and The Plot to Kill King, three books that go very, very, very deeply down the rabbit hole into this deed that was done with the blessings, or I should say cursings, of our own government and governance. And I think the way that we heal this is we reveal this. One final question. What are your are you traveling around the country? Are you at this as we approach the 50th anniversary of the assassination next year? Do you have plans to continue this promo during this period of time?
Well, I mean, if people want to hear what I have to say, I'm willing to give interviews. If people want to read the book, of course, I'm very happy that they will read the book. I think we know more. And very carefully, listen to this very carefully. I think we know more actual factual details about this major assassination than any assassination in history. I think we have learned more of the actual details, the day-to-day details of how this was carried out, more than any assassination in history. And that's only because I have been able to stay with it for over 40 years and to let people come forward as they are nearing the grave and provide information, provide evidence on the basis of their conscience, finally giving them that motivation. So I think it's an extraordinary lesson if one wants to understand how such a major assassination is carried out. I think it's important to understand that. I, as you probably know, I agreed to become the lawyer for Sirhan, and I was close to Bob Kennedy as well, and I took on the Sirhan case because the evidence of his innocence was so profound and was so great also that I thought, well, I can't let this one go. So I took it on, and we have represented Sirhan now since 2007 when his last lawyer died. But nowhere have we had, in that case, the degree of detail that we've been able to develop with respect to the assassination of Martin King.
Very, very interesting. There's much, much more to talk about. There's 700 or 800 pages of detail, and as you say, it is the most detailed investigation and corroboration of any assassination in history. I want to thank you so much, Bill Pepper, for being with us today, and also for the work that you've done for this past period of time. And I know that you were of great benefit to those people that wanted to relieve their conscience. I think that you gave them the opportunity to do that, and I thank you for serving that scene as well. So thank you, good luck, and may the story emerge, and soon.
Thank you very much. It's It's good to speak with people like you who are really interested in seeing the truth be revealed to the public of this country.
Well, we have a new saying called, "The truth shall upset you free." So thanks again, Bill.
Indeed. Bye. Thanks very much.
Hello, this is Swami Beyondananda, political guru and uncommentator, and welcome to Karma Talk, where we talk about our collective karma and our individual karma. Well, you just heard some very, very interesting revelations. And you know, all the time people are talking about these conspiracy theories. Well, my definition of a conspiracy theory is a conspiracy theory is something which, if it were true, you couldn't deal with it. I prefer the word conspiracy because we have been conned into believing a lot of things that are not true, and the pirates, these confidence men pirates, have actually stolen the Commonwealth under our eyes by keeping us divided and conquered. We have a deeply divided body politic in this country. Half the population believes our elections are broken, the other half believes that they're fixed. And so in this particular state, most people really know that they are not being told the truth. And now, of course, the veils are being lifted, and we are learning more about the deep state. It's going to be very frightening to people. Until you recognize that we can cultivate the deeper state of love, the deeper state of community, the deeper state of laughter and coherence, and we can metabolize all of this residuedo. Because let's face it, we have been ruled by the lowest common denominator for about 5,000 years. And we are still reeling from this, and that is why the sociopathogens have been in charge. Well, here's what we have to do. We have to actually let all of the truth come out. We have to metabolize this stuff in a field of love and laughter. And this is the question that is coming up right now. Can we undo the doo-doo that has been done? Or will the done doo-doo be our undoing? So I'm hoping that you hold this with a lot of love and a lot of laughter. Till we meet again, namaste and namasko. Goodbye.
G-U-R-U, 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 G-U-R-U.